So tonight we're starting a new series. I'll do the first one, and I'm going to do the next three, and then I'll finish up with the last two. And it's on our first Chinese ancestors. This is from the Denko Roku by Keizan, also called Transmission of the Light. There are two translations that I'm using. One is by Francis Cook, and the other is by Thomas Cleary. So guess who our first ancestor is? Bodhidharma. At least our first Chinese ancestor. We're not starting with the Indians. Our first ancestor, of course, is Bodhidharma, and we're all familiar with him. But I want to present Keizan to you, whom we are less familiar with. It is actually surprising that we may be less familiar with him, as along with Dogen, he is considered the co-founding patriarch of Soto Zen. And thus we have two main temple headquarters of Soto Zen, Dogen's Aheiji and Keizan's Sojiji. Two temples, one essence. A few weeks ago, there was a big celebration of the 700 years since Keizan opened the Dharma Hall at Sojiji, and that was attended by our Franks Ostaseki, Kaz Tanahashi, and Joan Halifax, among multitudes of others. Keizan studied under Gikai and was recognized by Ajo, Dogen's Dharma heir. Keizan entered Aheiji quite young, 8 years old, and he studied with Dogen's successor, Ajo. SZBA, the Soto Zen Buddhists of America, held a conference on Keizan back in 2010. And the study material is 176 pages long. Now, I was at Sojiji at that time with Norman and our priest group. What is notable about Keizan is the number of monasteries and temples he founded. He actively promoted women becoming nuns, and one of his main benefactors was the woman Sonin, who became abbess of a nunnery and donated her time and her home to Keizan, which became Sojiji in northern Japan. It eventually burned down in 1898 and was rebuilt in 1911, moving to Yokohama, by which time there were thousands of sub-temples of Sojiji. Keizan's legacy, the Denko Roku, or Transmission of the Light, is taken from his Teishos. Teisho is a short lecture, and all these hagiographies are short. Hagiographies are idealized images of saints, or in our case, our patriarchs. They're written by his disciples, and there may be some mistakes in copying what he said. Keizan used source material from China in creating the Denko Roku. Mostly the genealogies, Jing De Xuan Deng Lu, and the Wu Deng Hui Yuan. The transmission of the light is a lineage from Buddha up through Ajo, Dogen's heir. Here, the light is meant as Satori, or enlightenment stories, or awakening stories. The whole Denko Roku is really a study of Satori. It is by no means a complete listing of our ancestors. There's a lot of notable people missing. A great many notables are left out. This is not like a family tree with familial bloodlines, but rather a spiritual bloodline. In China, these stories are often called fire histories, as it was the fire in the lamps. There are many reasons to write such a document, not the least of which is to establish one's own legitimacy and the legitimacy of the Soto lineage. Soto was still new in Japan. Kazan was born just a few years after Dogen's death, and there was much connection in from other Buddhist sects, which preceded Soto or grew up at the same time in the 14th century, such as Durumushu, which was founded by Nonin. Nonin achieved self-awakening without working with any teacher. Rinzai was also prevalent, plus Tendai and Pure Land teachings, and Nichiren was also around. Many of the monks at Aheiji had come first from these other schools, and as much as Dogen tried to keep his Zen pure of these influences, it really didn't work out. Eijo's heir, Gikai, favored a more syncretic approach, and he was eventually thrown out of Aheiji. Kazan went on to study with Gikai at Dao Jiji and was recognized later by Eijo. In establishing himself as a patriarch of Soto Zen, he realized the nature of the Japanese culture as being lay, with simple religious sentiments. Their Buddhist beliefs also incorporated a lot of mysticism, such as beliefs in kami, the spirits inhabiting trees and rocks and inanimate objects. Kazan also firmly believed in these things, as well as prophetic dreams. As a matter of fact, he hardly ever did anything without a big dream coming on first. I tell you this because it helps explain the mythic nature of a lot of these stories. This is especially true of the stories of our Indian ancestors, and perhaps helps us understand the story of Huike, who was Bodhidharma's heir, whom Norman will take up next week, and thankfully not I. So we really take the transmission of the light with a grain of salt. As I have said, it was instructional material in regards to Satori. Dogen taught that Zazen is enlightenment, and yet experiences of realization were still honored. He did not value the koan-like Satori of Rinzai Zen. Satori, or awakening, is seen more as a beginning step, and it is how one matures in practice and compassion that is what is valued. Kazan is sometimes referred to as the mother of Soto Zen, and Dogen as the father. So today there are two main temples of Soto Zen, but the teaching is one stream, one essence. Kazan recognized the importance of benefactors, of course, and so created a lot of rituals to honor and cultivate the donors. People wanted blessings, and he gave it to them. Now, each of these stories begins with the enlightenment case, and is followed, or transmission case, and is followed by an explanation of the ancestor's circumstances. Birth, influences, significant interactions with teachers, and so on. Then, following that, there is a teisho, or teaching by Kazan, and ending with a short poem. Kazan did not include himself in this hagiography, but we know his circumstances pretty well. There is no mention of his father, but he was raised by his mother and grandmother. Both were very religious and worshipped Avalokitesvara, also called Kanon in Japan. Kazan continued this in his temples and monastery, having been strongly influenced by his mother and grandmother. There were halls that were dedicated to Kanon. His mother Eikon became abbess of a convent named Jojoji. We continue his devotion to Kanon by chanting the Enme Juku Kanon Gyo, where we appeal to Kanon for the well-being of those who have passed and the health of others. As I read these stories, I had to ask myself deep questions about the why and wherefore of the Denko Roku, and delve into Kazan himself, so that I might begin to understand why he wrote such things and why some of my favorite lineage holders were excluded. Before I get into Bodhidharma specifically, I want to address why we study these biographies. How does this relate to my day-to-day existence here in 2024? I believe that the answer lies in studying Satori and subsequent activity, like abiding in the absolute, but practicing in the everyday world, the Saha world, of picking and choosing. We bring our practice off the cushion and into our interactions. Some of the esoteric practices that were part of Kazon's monastic code were already a part of Buddhist monasticism, such as mystical formulas known as dharanis, which we still chant today. In a way, the lectures on the lineage were to emphasize the legitimacy of Zen transmission, and yet it is so much more. Kazon's writings also emphasize the need to study under a sanctioned Zen teacher, even if one were self-enlightened like Nonin and his Darumashu sect. Kazon also set up the abbots of Yokoji to be alternating. Yokoji was the first temple that he founded. And that's a system that we employ at Zen Center today. So, shall we talk about Bodhidharma? Please remember this is a story, an account of our first ancestor in China. Much is clouded in mystery, and stories are still being made up about Bodhidharma and Shaolin Monastery today by movie makers in Hong Kong. Bodhidharma is one of Jamie and my favorites. She thinks he is quite funny, striving so hard for 9 years, sitting zazen in a cave, when she says Zen is all about letting go. He strives so hard that legend has it his eyebrows fell off and became the first tea leaves in China. There are three pictures of him in our house. Here, one from Kyoto, from an abbot of Daitokuji, and one by me, which is coming up. So, we honor him, Bodhidharma, as the first patriarch of Zen or Chan, as it is known in China. Other Buddhist teachings, sutras, etc., had already made their way to China, but not the meditation we call Zazen. There were many other influences, such as Confucianism, just after Buddhist time, and Taoism, which is more aligned with these new teachings. Thus, Bodhidharma is our founder, our first ancestor in Zen. There are four periods of Chan Buddhism in China, and Proto-Zen begins with Bodhidharma. Early Chan begins with the fifth ancestor and is known for the East Mountain teachings, although it is also marked by a move to the metropolitan capitals of Luoyang and Chang'an, which was the most populous city in the world at the time. Probably 1 million people lived there. So according to the Denko Roku, Bodhidharma is the 28th patriarch after Prajnatara in India. At this point, I should tell you that there are two translations again, one by Francis Cook and the other by Thomas Cleary. Cleary makes Bodhidharma number 29 by counting Buddha as number one. Cook makes Bodhidharma the 28th ancestor, and what we normally consider to be the 28th ancestor, by counting Mahakasyapa as the first to get transmission from the Buddha. Clary doesn't actually say Bodhidharma or any of the ancestors are some numbered ancestor, but he just makes them each ancestor the next in the line as a chapter heading. Our story begins in India, with Prajnatara giving Bodhidharma his transmission. The case goes like this. The Venerable Prajnatara asks Bodhidharma, "What among all things is formless?" Bodhidharma responded, "Non-origination is formless." Now Cook has this as, "Non-arising is formless." Prajnatara then asks, "What among all things is the greatest?" To which Bodhidharma responds, "The true nature of reality is the greatest." So this is the exchange from whence Bodhidharma is recognized. Actually, he was called Bodhitara at the time. From here, Keizan's Denkoroku, or transmission of the light, goes into the story of Bodhidharma, followed by his short lecture, and finalized by a small verse. So, in the Denkoroku, Bodhidharma was the third son of the king of Koshi. The king of Oraja was a devout Buddhist and gave this venerable Prajnatara a very precious gem as a gift. Prajnatara wanted to test the wisdom of the three princes, so he showed them the precious jewel and asked them, "Is there anything comparable to this jewel?" The first and second sons responded, "This jewel is the most precious of the seven treasures. There's certainly none better. Only someone of your power and sanctity could receive it." The third son, Bodhidharma, said, "This is a worldly treasure, and yet it is still not the best. Among all jewels, the jewels of Dharma is the best of treasures. The light of this jewel is worldly light, and still does not qualify as the best. I consider the light of wisdom to be the best of lights. The sparkle of this jewel cannot shine by itself. It needs the light of wisdom to discern its sparkle. Once you thoroughly discern it, you know it is a jewel. Then you clarify the fact that it is precious. Its preciousness itself is not precious. When you discern the jewel itself is not a jewel. The jewel is not a jewel in itself, because we need the jewel of knowledge to distinguish it as a jewel in the worldly sense. Value isn't value in itself because we need the treasure of knowledge to understand the value of truth. Because your way," and here he means Prajnatara, "is a treasure of knowledge, you have been rewarded with a worldly treasure. So that treasure has appeared because there is enlightenment in you, just as the treasure of mind appears in anyone with enlightenment." Hearing the eloquent explanation of the third prince, the Buddhist master Prajnatara knew that he was an incarnated sage and perceived that the prince would be his spiritual successor. He knew the time was not yet ripe, however, so he kept silent and did not single him out. So this was from Cleary's translation, which seemed easier to understand. Nonetheless, I will read from Cook's translation. "I consider the light of wisdom to be the best of all brightnesses. The bright light of this jewel cannot illuminate itself, but needs the light of wisdom in order for it to be discerned. Once you thoroughly discern it, You know it is a jewel. Then you can clarify the fact that it is precious. When you clarify that it is precious, its preciousness is not itself precious. When you discern the jewel itself is not a jewel. The jewel's not being a jewel is because it is necessary to use the jewel of wisdom in order to discern the worldly jewel. The preciousness not being itself precious is because it is necessary to use the treasure of wisdom to clarify the treasure of the Dharma. Because of the Master's way is the treasure of wisdom, you now experience this worldly treasure. Thus, when the Master has the way, this treasure appears. And when beings have the way, the treasure of mind also appears. It seemed to me that Cook's version was a little bit more confusing, but I think we get the gist of it. I will be blending the two versions, Cook's and Cleary's, using language I find most helpful. So later, Prajnatara asked the young prince, "What among all things is formless?" Bodhidharma replied, "Non-arising is formless." So this is also called non-origination. Then the venerable master asked, "What among all things is the greatest?" Bodhidharma responds, "The nature of reality is the greatest." Even though they questioned and answered in this manner, and the mind of the master and disciple merged, still, Prajnatara deemed the time was still not ripe and waited for the complete maturing of conditions. When the king died, Bodhidharma went into samadhi in front of the coffin. After 7 days, he went to Prajnatara to request ordination as a Buddhist monk. Prajnatara knew that the time was now ripe, and Bodhidharma sat with Prajnatara for 7 days, where Prajnatara lectured him extensively in the wonderful principles of Zazen, as well as giving him the Lankavatara Sutra. It was at this time that the prince Bodhidharma was named Bodhidharma, as Dharma means greatness of comprehension. It was determined at this time that Bodhidharma would stay in southern India for quite a while studying with Prajnatara, after which he would go to China to teach. He was cautioned not to stay in southern China, but to move north, where he would find people who were willing to receive the Dharma. In verse, this was, "Traveling the road, crossing the water, you will meet a sheep. Going alone without rest, you will cross the river in the dark. Under the sun, a nice pair, elephant and horse. Two young cinnamon trees will flourish forever. You will meet someone in the woods who will realize enlightenment." Again, in verse. "Though China is vast, there is no other road. You need successors to follow in your footsteps. A golden rooster will be able to pick up a single grain and support all the saintly people in the world." So this verse serves as a prophecy of what would unfold. After decades had passed, Bodhidharma had become quite famous in India, but he realized it was time for him to go to China. Prajnatara had passed on some time ago, so Bodhidharma went to the king and told him it was time for him to spread the Dharma. The king was grief-stricken and asked, "What's wrong with this land? What makes China so auspicious?" Bodhidharma promised to return when his work was done. And this king said, "Come right back and don't forget the land of your parents." So Bodhidharma took off, sailing for 3 years before reaching southern China in 527. Now, some scholars place this date as 479, but this story makes more sense if we use 527 as the date. This is where he had his famous interview with the Emperor Wu. The details of this encounter are strangely left out of the Denko Roku, but I'll give them to you anyway. This is the very first case in the Blue Cliff record, and it's called The Highest Meaning of the Holy Truth. Case: Emperor Wu of Liang was famous for building monasteries for Buddhists, and he asked the great master Bodhidharma, oh, and stupas too, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? Bodhidharma said, empty without holiness. The emperor said, who is facing me? Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. The emperor did not understand. Other versions of this have the emperor asking, what merit have I earned? With Bodhidharma answering, no merit. The piqued emperor then asks, who is facing me? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. The emperor didn't understand, and Bodhidharma left. So this was a sheep that Prajnatara warned Bodhidharma about and advised him not to stay in the south. So it was then that Bodhidharma headed north and crossed the Yangtze River on a reed, according to myth, but a reed is also a small craft. Still, plenty of artists have painted Bodhidharma crossing the river on a reed. He ended up in a cave at Shaolin on Mount Song. At this point, I'm going to leave the Denko Roku to return shortly. I want to quote Thich Nhat Hanh from his book, Zen Keys, A Guide to Zen Practice. This is a book I heartily recommend and was lent to me by Gurdjieff. Thank you, Gurdjieff. In a section about Bodhidharma's statement, he says, according to Bodhidharma, Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures, not based on words or letters, a direct pointing to the heart of reality, so that we might see into our own nature and wake up. In the 5th century, when Bodhidharma came to China, Chinese Buddhists were studying Buddhist texts that had recently been translated. They were occupied more with systemizing the ideas and forming Buddhist sects rather than practicing meditation. Bodhidharma's statement was like a thunderclap to wake them up and bring them to the practice and the experiential side of Buddhism. Bodhidharma said, Zen has been transmitted directly by the Buddha and has nothing at all to do with the scriptures and doctrines you are studying. Bodhidharma's statement is very much in the tradition and is merely a drastic way to bring people to a direct spiritual experience. Further on, Thich Nhat Hanh writes under the heading, The Moment of Awakening. To reach truth is not to accumulate knowledge, but to awaken to the heart of reality. Reality reveals itself complete and whole at the moment of awakening. In the light of awakening, nothing is added, nothing is lost. Emotions based on concepts no longer affect us. If Bodhidharma is an ideal person, it is because he has broken the chains of illusion that bind us to the world of concepts. The hammer used to break these chains is the practice of Zen. The moment of awakening may be marked by an outburst of laughter, but this is not the laughter of someone who has won the lottery or some kind of victory. It is the laughter of someone who, after searching for something for a long time, suddenly finds it in the pocket of his coat. So perhaps now, Thich Nhat Hanh has clarified Cleary and Cook's translation of the transmission of the lamp and the case for Satori. By the practice of Zen, he means Zazen. So, back to our hero. He is now at Shaolin Temple, after meeting the sheep of Prajnatara's verse, that is, the Emperor Wu. Bodhidharma now enters deep Zazen for 9 years and earns the nickname the Wall Contemplating Brahmin. After 9 years, having bequeathed his skin, flesh, bones, and marrow to his four disciples, Dao Fu, Dao Yu, Kongxi, and Huike, he knew that their potentials had matured. And at that time, there were two non-believers named Bodhihiruchi and Precept Master Guanglu, who took umbrage at the fame of Bodhidharma spreading far and wide. They would throw stones at him and finally tried to poison him 5 times. On their 6th attempt, Bodhidharma put the poison on a boulder and the boulder split, which means he passed on. He realized that by now his mission was over, and there was great capacity in China for receiving the Dharma of the Great Vehicle. It took him a while before he met anyone who could pass his transmission, that he could pass his transmission to. But finally he met Huike, and thus he transmitted all of the way to him. Having done this, my time is ended, he said. So saying, he sat up and passed away. He is buried on Bear Ear Mountain. It is said that later he met a man named Song Yun on the Su Range, or that there was one shoe left in his grave and he was carrying one shoe. But the fact remains, he's buried on Bear Ear Mountain. So now Kazon begins his Taisho, or short lecture. Based on the instruction and final direction of the Buddhist master Prajnatara, Bodhidharma became the founder of Zen in China. Here, Kazon is again establishing his place in the lineage by firmly asserting that such a lineage exists. We will find that many times Kazon leaves out a lot of narrative and a lot of famous cases handed down in other texts, because one of his primary goals, besides presenting Satori stories and instruction, is to establish this lineage. He goes on, in the beginning, when Bodhidharma explained about the jewel, Prajnatara said, what among all things is formless? Bodhidharma said, non-origination is formless. And Kazon remarks, even if you speak of empty silence, actually, this is not formless. Therefore, he said, non-origination is formless. Thus, one would understand it is like a sheer cliff. One would understand it as being clear in everything and recognize that everything is nothing else, just abiding in its normal state. But this is not the unoriginated, so it is not formless. I perhaps should have left this little part out because Kazon is just making a case for something that was not said by Bodhidharma. Like if Bodhidharma had responded, nothingness, but he didn't. Kazon, on reflection about Bodhidharma's response, says, before heaven and earth are separated, how could holy and ordinary be distinguished? In this realm, meaning the absolute, there's not a single thing to appear, not a mote of dust that can defile. But it is not that there is originally nothing. Then, in the realm of the absolute, you are empty and open, spiritually aware, wide awake, and unconfused. Here, There's nothing to compare, and never has anything accompanied it. Therefore is the greatest of the great. That is why it is said that the great is called inconceivable, and the inconceivable is called the nature of reality. Even a priceless jewel cannot compare with it. Even the clear light of mind cannot represent it. Therefore, Bodhidharma said, the jewel had a mundane luster and could not be considered supreme. That the luster of wisdom is supreme. This is how he understood it. Though his explanation was truly from natural wisdom, yet he sat in meditation for 7 days listening to the subtle teachings of meditation, and thus he developed supreme knowledge of the way. Kazan again recounts Bodhidharma's spiritual journey as he travels, ending up at Shaolin Temple, and ending with Bodhidharma acquiring a successor and fulfilling his promise to his master. I'm not going to go into all that because we've been through it. His hardships were the greatest, and his hardships and the austerities the most severe. Kazan ends his taisho with a commentary to his disciples. However, students these days hope that it will be easy. Despite the degeneracy of the times and the weakness of capabilities, I am afraid that people like these, who say they understood what they have not, are proud, arrogant fellows who should retire, like the 500 arhats in the Lotus Sutra. People, if you thoroughly penetrate the foregoing story, understand its loftiness more and more, smash the mind, abandon the body, and intimately discern the way, you will get secret help from the Buddhas and directly share what the Buddha patriarchs have proven. Do not think that a morsel of knowledge or half an understanding is sufficient. And Kazan's finishing verse is as follows. There is no distinction or location, no edge or outside. Is there anything at all, even in the slightest? Clearly, Kazan's talking about true reality, the world of the awakened one, the absolute, the place of non-dualism, so no distinction. So, this is the case of Bodhidharma, our first ancestor in China. I made a note to myself as I was reading the Denko Roku, asking myself, how do we relate to this today? Keeping this in mind, I listened to a talk the other day by our beloved Florence Kaplow. She had 3 weeks earlier lost her mother, and her talk was dedicated to her. The talk was titled, All Beings Are Our Ancestors. What could be more appropriate? This talk was given at the Ancient Dragon Zen Gate in Chicago. And in her talk, she has us look at the palm of our hand and look and see our link to our ancestors. And therefore, we must respond with gratitude. We play it forward and repay kindness with open hearts and compassion. She says, all beings are our mother. We should see them as such, no matter what your relationship with your mother was. There is a kindness in seeing all beings as our ancestors. She used the same analogy that Norman used on Saturday in his lecture on compassion. It was Dao Wu responding to Yun Yan and saying that his natural reaction is like reaching back behind your head for the pillow. I think this is one of Norman's favorite cases because I've heard it so many times. It is case 54 in the Book of Serenity. Yun Yan asks Dao Wu, what does a bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Dawu said. It is like someone reaching back for the pillow at night. Yunyan said, I understand. Dawu says, how do you understand? Yunyan replies, all over the body is hands and eyes. Dawu says, that's 80% right. The whole body is hands and eyes. Norman says that this means the whole body is compassion. So what I take from the case is Dao Wu's reaching back for the pillow at night. You don't think about it. It's a natural act. The appropriate response that comes from empty space. Florence also brought up a teaching that she got from Sokni Rinpoche at a retreat. I've also attended a couple of retreats with Sokni Rinpoche and heard the same teaching. Sokni is warning students to avoid dropping into stupid shamatha, that is just sitting with a calmness that is not deep meditation at all. This is not being grateful to the wonderful teachings of our ancestors. So I think it is worth mentioning, since I too have sometimes found myself sitting in stupid shamatha, instead of cultivating the empty field. Obviously, Bodhidharma is all about meditation. And he also passed the link of a Tara Sutra to Huike. Thank you. For further study, I can recommend John McRae's book, Seeing Through Zen, Encounters, Transformation, and Genealogy in Chinese Chan Buddhism. So now, in groups of three, let's talk about our relationship to the ancestors and their teachings. How does it relate to us all these centuries later, and what is going on now? All our usual precautions still hold. Please do not repeat anything you hear in breakout rooms, and honor our confidentiality. Maya will put us in groups of three, and we will each have 4 minutes to talk. I will ring a bell after 4 minutes are up each time.